With that, our executive director, Ali Abu Nima, with his opening remarks. Ali.
Thanks, Nora. On Friday, Israel cut all internet, mobile, and landline communications to and from and within the Gaza Strip. Under the cover of this darkness, Israel escalated its atrocities against the population. No one outside Gaza could learn the fate of their friends or family. No one inside could call for help. Ambulance crews, the bravest of the brave, could not be dispatched to try to rescue people from under the rubble of their homes, destroyed by American bombs. After the connection started to be partially restored on Sunday, we learned from the Wall Street Journal that it was the United States government that had instructed Israel to turn the internet and phone network in Gaza back on. What does this tell us? It's a stark confirmation that every Israeli decision in this genocidal extermination campaign against Palestinian civilians in Gaza is actually an American decision made in Washington. Just as Joe Biden's officials could tell Israel to turn the internet on, they could also tell Israel to stop the bombing, to stop the slaughter of Palestinian civilians, whose toll has now exceeded 8,000 people, almost half of them children. Israel cannot carry out this slaughter without American permission and approval. Were it not for the massive airlift ordered by Biden, Israel would by now have run out of bombs. Each and every one of us must recognize this. Yes, it is Israelis pulling the trigger, but it is Washington that is giving the orders and support. But slaughtering Palestinians is not the Biden administration's only goal. Even for people this psychopathic, bloodthirsty, and cruel, murdering the entire population of 2.3 million people in Gaza might be a step too far. Or at least I would hope so, given that this is the same political class that thought killing 500,000 Iraqi children with the Clinton administration sanctions was worth it to achieve America's imperial goals in the region. The real goal of this attack on Gaza, and one the Israelis themselves don't try to hide, is the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian population and the completion of the Nakba of 1948. On Saturday, Dawn, Democracy in the Arab World Now, a group founded by murdered Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi, warned that the Biden administration is tacitly assisting these plans by asking Congress for supposed humanitarian aid funding that would help Palestinians displaced from Gaza to neighboring countries. Dawn notes that Israeli actions, statements, and directives all push in the direction of ethnic cleansing, including a leaked policy document drafted by the Israeli Intelligence Ministry that recommends the permanent forced transfer of Palestinians in Gaza to Sinai. The Biden administration isn't just giving a green light for ethnic cleansing, it's bankrolling it, said Sarah Lee Whitson, Dawn's executive director. Gaslighting Americans into facilitating long-held Israeli plans to depopulate Gaza under the cover of humanitarian aid is a cruel and grotesque hoax, Whitson said. I can only agree with that and warn once again that the charade of providing humanitarian aid through the Rafah crossing is a distraction. The amount of supplies flowing through remains a tiny, insignificant trickle and cannot mitigate the enormous humanitarian catastrophe deliberately being inflicted by Israel and the United States by cutting off water, food, fuel, and medicine. The way to help Palestinians in Gaza is an immediate ceasefire and an end to the Israeli biological warfare against 2.3 million people. Because biological warfare is what it is when you deliberately subject civilians to starvation, dehydration, a lack of sanitation amid forced displacement and incessant indiscriminate bombing. According to the UN, water consumption in Gaza has plunged by 92%. How long can life go on like that? And on Sunday, the United Nations reported that hospitals are facing unprecedented levels of devastation, primarily driven by the overwhelming number of injuries, critical shortages of vital resources, and concerns of being targeted by airstrikes. Over the last 24 hours, Israel bombed the vicinity of Al-Quds Hospital in the north of Gaza, affecting staff, patients, and 14,000 internally displaced people. In the same period, residential buildings near the Indonesian hospital in Beit Lahia and Shifa Hospital in Gaza City were hit, also by airstrikes. Today, Israeli bombing caused severe damage and terror at the Turkish Friendship Hospital, which treats cancer patients in Gaza. I would not be surprised if that was Israel's deliberate response to the Turkish president's condemnation of its genocidal crimes. In one welcome and important development, Karim Khan, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, made an unannounced visit to the Rafah crossing on the Egypt-Gaza border on Sunday. There and in Cairo, he made his first significant comments about the situation in Palestine since the 7th of October, and indeed since he came to office. Khan, who jumps whenever the Americans tell him to, when it comes to investigating alleged war crimes in Ukraine, has been dragging his feet on the court's investigation of crimes in Palestine that formally began more than 2 years ago. Khan said, "We have active investigations ongoing in relation to the crimes allegedly committed in Israel on 7 October and also in relation to Gaza and the West Bank, and our jurisdiction goes back to 2014. The prosecutor warned, and I think this is probably the most important thing he said, that blocking the delivery of humanitarian supplies to Gaza, as Israel is doing, may constitute a war crime. He said that Israel must make discernible efforts without further delay to make sure civilians receive basic foods and medicine. Lawyers for Palestinian Human Rights, an organization based in the UK, said that by making these comments, Khan properly carried out his responsibility to deter apparent violations by providing a public warning to the parties to the conflict. That may be correct, but Khan has dragged his feet for years, and even though a preventive statement is necessary and welcome, it is not enough. Khan has more than enough evidence to issue indictments and arrest warrants for Israeli leaders based on their genocidal statements and actions, and he must do so. What more evidence is needed? The UK charity Save the Children said on Sunday that the number of children reported killed in Gaza in just 3 weeks has surpassed the annual number of children killed across all the world's conflict zones since 2019. I cannot but recall bitterly that just a few months ago, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres acknowledged that the Israeli army is one of the world's worst abusers of children's rights. Yet despite this, and in defiance of the recommendation of his experts, Guterres refused to add Israel to the UN's so-called list of shame, a list of the groups or entities that are most violent towards children in armed conflict zones. For years, Guterres has employed a double standard by listing some parties on his list of shame while omitting others that have often committed far more violations, Human Rights Watch said at the time. And I wrote that by keeping Israel off the list, the UN chief was sending a clear message to Tel Aviv that it could continue killing Palestinian children with impunity. And here we are. I mention this to emphasize that it is the impunity that Israel enjoys due to the willful inaction and complicity of people like Khan and Guterres and many others in the so-called international community that has given Israel the confidence that it can openly butcher thousands of people before the eyes of the world without any fear of consequences. It's time for that to change, and the only way it will is when Israel faces consequences through boycotts, sanctions, arms embargoes, and indictments, as well as through the legitimate resistance of the Palestinian people. And for that to happen, all of us need to keep up the pressure in every way we can, especially by continuing to protest. I want to leave you with the words of three prominent Palestinian human rights groups, Al-Haq, Al-Mizan, and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. They say, the looming mass ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in Gaza requires immediate intervention. It must also be recalled that more than three quarters of Gaza's populations are refugees, to whom Israel, the occupying power, has denied the right of return to their homes and lands since 1948. 7 decades on, the international community continues to fail to realize the right of return to millions of Palestinian refugees explicitly recognized under the United Nations General Assembly Resolution 194. The atrocities we are currently witnessing in Gaza, including genocidal acts, will haunt humanity for decades to come. Our organizations renew their call to the international community for an immediate ceasefire. This must be accompanied by the unimpeded entry of fuel and humanitarian aid, including water, food, and medical supplies to be distributed throughout the entire Gaza Strip to alleviate the ongoing humanitarian catastrophe caused by Israeli policies of collective punishment against Gaza's civilian population. These atrocities must not only end, they must never happen again. The international community must ensure that Israel's settler colonial apartheid regime is dismantled, that all discriminatory and dehumanizing laws and policies and practices against the Palestinian people are rescinded in full, that Israel immediately and unconditionally withdraw from the occupied Palestinian territory, and that the Palestinian people can fully exercise their inalienable right to self-determination.
Thank you so much, Ali Abu Nima. He is our executive director here at the Electronic Intifada, and we're going to have a lot more analysis and discussion about not just the humanitarian catastrophe on the ground in Gaza, but also the West Bank. We're going to be talking about the role of Jordan, and we're going to bring on our colleague Tamara Nassar. And we're also going to talk about new testimonies and appeals from some of the Israeli captives to their government, which seems all too willing to just sacrifice them and continue to carpet bomb Gaza. But first, Asa, why don't you introduce our next guest?
Our next guest is Huda Amouri, the co-founder of Palestine Action. Palestine Action, many of our viewers and listeners will be familiar with. It's an organization which was founded 3 years ago, a little over 3 years ago now, to take action for Palestine, as the name suggests. So it's about direct action. It's about taking solidarity to the next level, in a way, that taking direct action against companies that are involved in the Israeli genocide in Gaza right now. There's all sorts. Their prime target has been Elbit, but there's been others as well. Welcome to the show, Huda.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on here.
Hi, Huda.
Hi.
Well, could you start maybe by, giving your reaction to what's been going on in Gaza, and then maybe talk about what Palestine Action has been doing about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to put into words, which I think you guys have been doing a brilliant job of, about talking about the reaction to what's been happening in the past few weeks. You know, you see people being slaughtered on a daily basis. You're seeing hospitals being attacked, people being told to flee to one area and then being killed when they go to another area. It's just genocide, and it's quite sick in the way that they're carrying it out as well. There's that mental element, which just seems evil beyond the evil, to, you know, warn people to go to one area, bomb them while they're on the way to that area. I think it's been obvious for many years, if not decades, that there's no safe place in Gaza. I think this current situation is just highlighting that. Thankfully, in one sense, I don't have direct family in Gaza, but I have plenty of friends who have lost their whole families in these recent attacks. And, you know, I'm sure that the grief and rage that we are feeling is being shared by many across the world. But in Palestine Action, we have been focused on taking direct action against Israeli weapons manufacturers. Our main target, as you said, is Elbit Systems, which is Israel's largest weapons firm. We know that before this past month, they have been developing their weapons on the population of Gaza for many, many years, marketing their drones as battle-tested, parts of which are built in Britain. They're the ones who are supplying the bullets that Israel are using. They provide 85% of their land-based equipment, and they're the majority provider for the Israeli military. So we can trace back not just to Elbit Systems, but to many other companies who facilitate Elbit Systems, who supply them and who work alongside them, who are complicit and are arming this genocide against the Palestinian people. And just recently, we saw the Iron Sting missiles being used for the first time. It's a new weapon. And again, they are using this as an opportunity to test out new weaponry. And it's been leaving marks and burns that that Palestinians have not seen before. So whenever we're seeing these attacks, we can trace it back. But also we know that they're using these attacks as opportunities to try and make more money off the back of Palestinian blood, and to test out new weaponry, which no doubt, unless we intervene, they will market it on the global arms trade. And we will probably see these weapons being bought by other countries in years to come. And I think for us in the Imperial Corps, but also across the world, where Elbit Systems are active, where we have weapons factory on our doorsteps, we have shown in Palestine Action, and we are continuing to take action, that we can shut these places down through sustained direct action. We have shut down one of Elbit's factories in a northern town in England. Their London headquarters as well, and cost them hundreds of millions of pounds. And we're seeing this campaign now go global. But I think at this specific time, this is a crucial point in history. This is a crucial time where we need to harness the support for the Palestinian people and move it towards material disruption to the weapons makers who are producing the weapons we're seeing being used against the Palestinian people.
Huda, can you talk a little bit more about that, especially as we saw over the weekend, 500,000 people were in the streets in London alone, as well as places all over the world. People are really motivated to stop, these factories from operating, to, get into the gears of these factories and these weapons manufacturers. What are you seeing in terms of the rise in sustained direct action from where you are in the UK?
Yeah, so, just as we're seeing these protests grow to an incredible scale, we're seeing a massive increase in people wanting to join Palestine Action. We encourage people to continue to join us and want to take direct action against these weapons manufacturers. We've not only targeted weapons manufacturers in these past couple of weeks, we also targeted the BBC. They were sprayed with red paint to symbolise the bloodshed of the Palestinian people. And I think although that is not usually our focus, we are quite focused on the weapons trade, we have seen how the media has been just as complicit in the genocide of the Palestinian people by manufacturing consent and spreading the lies of the Israeli military. We've seen people climb on top of the roof of Howmet, which is a weapons factory in Leicester, which provides the parts for Israel's F-35 fighter jets. These are the fighter jets and warplanes that we're seeing dropping bombs in Gaza right now. We can trace back the weaponry and components to many factories across this country. At the same time as that action, we had other people blockading the Leicester factory of Elbit Systems, which produces Israeli military drones. And we've also seen over 100 trade unionists blockade the entrance to Israel's weapons factory in Kent. And at the same time, we've seen people target Barclays, the investors of Elbit Systems. And I'm sure I'm missing some off the list, but I can say that with what is happening and with the increased frequency and intensification of the genocide against the Palestinian people, I'm sure that we will see many more direct action taken in the upcoming weeks. And I encourage those who are joining the protest, it is fantastic to see that type of solidarity, but to take it one step further and to take direct action against the Israeli war machine. It does sometimes lead to arrest. It does sometimes lead to 24 hours, possibly longer, in a police cell. But I think at this point in time, when we're seeing what these weapons are doing to the Palestinian people, it really is nothing in comparison. And to know that we are standing in solidarity with the Palestinians at such a crucial time, and also to see that we are part of a global movement. We are seeing people in the US, I believe, several people were just arrested in Cambridge, Massachusetts, for taking direct action against a local Elbit facility over there. We've seen activists in Australia also targeting Elbit Systems, and we are expecting to see other actions across other countries. So I think now is really the time for us to directly intervene in the Israeli war machine, put our bodies in the way, put ourselves in the way, because, you know, we've shown that with two people, it took two people to climb onto the roof of a factory and it shut down for the day. With 500,000 people, there will not be a single weapons factory left in this country to operate.
Could you talk a little bit more about the kind of repression that you've been facing as Palestine Action? I know you might be limited legally on certain things that you can say, but in general, in the UK in recent weeks, we've seen, you know, a real increase in the level of repression of solidarity in general. And I know that you yourself and some other of your comrades have got a big trial coming up soon. So could you talk a little bit about all of that?
Yeah, but I think in general, we can see that the state is doing everything possible to try and intimidate people. They're trying to change the law. And it's as if they need to meet a certain quota of arrests of people in order to please Suella Braverman and the state. That's what it seems to be going on at the moment. And of course, to please the Israeli apartheid state of Israel, it seems. And I think we've seen people targeted by the media, calls for arrests, things like that have massively increased. But, you know, at the same time, I think that this, all of that just turns into noise, if I'm completely honest with you. Like, I think if this was a different time, it might be feel slightly more intense. But I think when we're seeing what's happening in Gaza, you just shrug it off and you keep going, because there really is no other choice at this moment in time. I and seven others have a trial coming up in London in 2 weeks. I'm being trialed for blackmail, conspiracy to burgle and destroy Elbit Systems.
Could you explain what the blackmail was?
Yeah, so basically it's covering the first 6 months of Palestine Action and all of the actions that we did, which was quite a lot. And I basically put it like they're charging us for the actions and then they just put blackmail on top. They're basically saying that we, by demanding the landlord of Elbit Systems, the landlord of their London headquarters, which isn't there anymore, by demanding that they evict Elbit and by saying that we're going to continue to take action against them until they do, that we are being charged for blackmail for that purpose. But the thing is, with blackmail, it's only three of us that have been charged, another co-founder and someone else, all three are in this trial, is that they can not only imprison you for quite a long time, but they can also ban you from campaigning for life. So even after you serve a prison time, they can, if you sign a petition, if you do any types of campaigning, they can basically recall you to prison. So it's obviously extremely politically motivated charge. It did come after they had a meeting, after Dominic Raab, foreign secretary, had a meeting with the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs and Benny Gantz, Israel's defense minister, at the time. And they slapped us with these blackmail charges. But to be honest with you, we're more than ready to fight these charges in court. I think it's a joke. And I think that the only guilty party in these cases is the Israeli weapons trade and the state for acting on their behalf to protect them against protecting the rights of their own citizens.
Hoda, yeah, I'd just like to ask you, two things. You obviously are going to fight these charges. You're going to go into court and defend yourselves. And I'd guess you're going to say something like your actions are justified mm-hmm. because they're meant to prevent a much bigger crime, that you may be smashing windows and smashing doors. I don't know exactly what mm-hmm. I've seen some of the videos, and some of them you're quite determined to take apart these factories. And in some cases, I don't mean you, but members mm-hmm. of Palestine Action, I've seen videos where they've broken computers and broken other equipment, which under normal circumstances would be considered a crime if it's not your property. But mm-hmm. your defense is that you're preventing a bigger crime, which is the murder of Palestinian civilians. And that defense, if I understand it correctly, has actually worked in a number of these trials previously where members of Palestine Action have been brought forward. And of course, I'm assuming you would hope that the jury or the judge in your upcoming trial, which we will be covering for the Electronic Intifada, that the jury or the judge will agree with you and will find you not guilty of these various charges that are politically motivated. But you are prepared to go to prison if you don't succeed. Is that the determination you have to carry through this mission?
Yes, I mean, I think you set it out perfectly. I can't go into too much detail about the defences, but I would say that, you know, legally in this country, you are allowed to, there are defences to criminal damage. So for example, if a house was burning down and you had to smash the window to save people inside, you wouldn't, you know, that wouldn't be criminal damage because you did it to save lives. It's the same principle. If you see a child trapped in a house, you bang down the door is immaterial to the cost of, you know, to saving human life. So in general, it's about proving that these actions were justified, which is extremely easy to do, and that is how we will fight these charges.
And just to be clear, I'm just speaking based on the public reports I've read and that we've published about the previous trials. I'm not conveying any particular knowledge about your upcoming trial. I'm just talking about the general mm-hmm. principles involved, although of course we will be following it and hoping that you will of course succeed in this very important resistance to what is a death machine. It happens in nice looking office buildings that look very neat and they've got lovely car parks and landscaping and so on. But what's going on there is the planning for blowing babies apart and blowing children apart, this kind of images we see from Gaza. Is that what's happening in these buildings?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can't compare, you know, throwing some paint or smashing some machinery to the destruction and the spilling of Palestinian blood constantly. That's the Elbit Systems' whole business model is built on the destruction of Palestine. And by taking direct action, we aim to stop that. And we have seen just a few weeks ago, an activist who caused over £500,000 worth of damage to Arconic, who supplied materials for Israel's fighter jets, was found not guilty by a jury in Wolverhampton based on several different points, but based on the fact that he acted to save lives and that he acted to prevent the much greater damage that was happening in Palestine and specifically in Gaza. But I think either way, we are aware that what we have not done anything wrong, not morally and arguably not legally. But either way, we are prepared to go to prison for the actions that we have taken, because in comparison to what is happening to the Palestinian people, you can't compare it. And I think that throughout history, we have seen that that often by putting your liberty on the line is one of the only ways that we can change this constant complicity that is going on between, in this case, between Britain and the colonization of Palestine. And if it means that we have to go to prison to shut down these weapons factories, then so be it. But we will fight them at every single point, and we will aim to prove that Elbit Systems are the real criminals in this case, not us. And I genuinely believe that a jury of normal people, you know, of the general public, will not side with the interests of a powerful Israeli arms manufacturer, but will side with the interests of normal people and of the oppressed, and will understand why we would take the necessary action that we take to stop them. And I think it's also important to put it in the context of a country and a political system where there is really no democratic process to bring viable change between their ongoing complicity with the genocide of the Palestinian people. We've done it all. We've tried it all, the lobbying, the petitions, the protests. And when you're seeing people being massacred, I think it's the human thing to do to put yourself, you know, slightly on the line in comparison in order to shut them down.
That's Huda Amori. She's with Palestine Action UK. And I implore people to go to their website as well as Twitter. And there is now, as we had on last week, Palestine Action US. Huda Amori, we will, of course, be checking back with you regularly, especially as this trial goes forth. Thank you for all you do and for being with us today on the live stream.
Thanks, Huda.
Thank you for your amazing coverage as well during this time and in the past.
Thank you so much. And we're now going to turn to our colleague, John Elmer. We wanted to start this kind of analysis section with talking about the news that's come out just in the last few hours of captives, Israeli captives somewhere in Gaza who have been appealing to the Netanyahu administration to release them and release the Palestinian prisoners, which has been the demand of Palestinian resistance groups. Ali, do you want to kind of situate us in what's happening with the prisoner situation, and then we can...
Yeah, I think we should actually start by watching the video that was released this morning by Hamas and is all over the media, but we have actually subtitled it in English.
Great, let's go to that.
אנחנו נמצאים בשבי החמאס 23, כמה ימים? 23 ימים. אתמול הייתה מסיבת עיתונאים עם משפחות החטופים. אנחנו יודעים שהייתה אמורה להיות הפסקת אש, היית אמור לשחרר את כולנו, התחייבת לשחרר את כולנו, ובמקום זה אנחנו נוסעים במחדל הפוליטי, ביטחוני, צבאי, מדיני שלך, בגלל הפשלה הזאת שעשית בשביעי לאוקטובר, בגלל שלא היה צבא שם, אף אחד לא הגיע, אף אחד לא שמר עלינו, ואנחנו אזרחים תמימים, אזרחים שמשלמים מיסים למדינת ישראל, נמצאים בשבי, בתנאים לא תנאים. אתה הורג אותנו, אתה תהרוג, אתה רוצה להרוג את כולנו, אתה רוצה עם צהל להרוג את כולנו, לא מספיק טבחת בכולם, לא מספיק אזרחים ישראלים נהרגו, שחרר, שחרר אותנו עכשיו, שחרר את האזרחים שלהם, שחרר את האסירים שלהם, שחרר אותנו, שחרר את כולנו, תן לנו לחזור למשפחות שלנו, עכשיו!
Yeah, wow. Ali, break that down for us.
Yeah, I mean, that video was released this morning, and interestingly, it was released without any subtitles, either in Arabic or English. So it appears to have been clearly directed at the Israeli public. I'll just read you two paragraphs or two sentences from a report published by The Guardian this morning. And it says, the deepening IDF, that's Israeli incursion into Gaza, came amid dwindling Israeli public enthusiasm for a prolonged occupation. Support has fallen from 65% on 10 October to 46% now, according to a study by the Hebrew University. We see a continuation of the decline in support for occupying Gaza, said Nimrod Nir, a researcher at the social science faculty. The shock we saw in the first week, the rage we saw in the second, are slowly moderated, and now Israelis care more about the hostage situation and are less inclined to enter a full-scale occupation. So I think Hamas is clearly aware of the debate within Israel and is playing on that. And I think we can see that in another video that I think we have of Hamas military spokesperson Abu Ubaida.
لقد جرت اتصالات عديدة في ملف الأسرى، وكانت هناك فرصة للوصول إلى صيغة اتفاق فيه، لكن العدو ماطل ولم يبد جدية حقيقية لإنهاء معاناة أسراه، بل إن قصفه الهمجي وجرائمه المتواصلة أدت إلى قتل ما يقرب من 50 منهم حتى الآن. ومن هنا فإننا نقول للعدو وللعالم وبشكل واضح ومختصر، إن العدد الكبير من أسرى العدو لدينا ثمنه تبييض كامل السجون الصهيونية من كافة الأسرى، فإذا أراد العدو أن ينهي هذا الملف مرة واحدة فنحن مستعدون لذلك، وإذا أراد مساراً لتجزئة الملف فنحن جاهزون لذلك أيضاً.
Yeah, and that also over the weekend or yesterday, the families of the Israeli prisoners who are held in Gaza held a press conference, and many of them have been saying very clearly they support releasing all the Palestinian prisoners in exchange for all the people held in Gaza. So you see a broad consensus spanning the Abu Ubaida, the spokesperson of the Qassam Brigades, and a large section of the Israeli public. And that means that I think Netanyahu and the warmongering establishment in Israel are in quite a bind. And it's in that context that Israel is saying that it's escalating its ground invasion or ground operations in Gaza, although what they're doing is a little bit of a mystery, and that's what I think John is going to help us try to unravel. What are you seeing, John?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a logical response from people's families, that they want their people to come home. And it's really unbelievable that the Israeli state doesn't believe that that's a primary concern for them, especially when the day after the war, they're going to try to repopulate, presumably, these settlements along the borders. It's a really perplexing situation from the Israelis. The Palestinians have offered since the beginning that they would release prisoners. They've offered numerous different ways to do that. We just saw Abu Ubaida say you can do it any way you want. You want to do all prisoners for all prisoners? We can do it today. If you want to do it in segments, we can do it in segments. They've offered, you know, the parameters of the prisoner exchange are there. They were there for the Shalit exchange on the first day as well. And Israel decided to wait for 2,000 days while their soldier was in custody. So, yeah, it's not clear why Israel is sacrificing all of these people, these soldiers and civilians, why they're sacrificing them over a ground operation that hasn't really begun and really only involves, at this point, massacres from the air. There's the possibility, even if Israel's ground operation is their plan, there's a possibility to exchange prisoners before you kill them, which is mm-hmm. what they, according to Abu Ubaida, and not surprisingly, considering they're killing everybody else in these bombings as well, it's not all that surprising that they're killing their own people in these attacks.
John, if I can ask you, when you look at that video of the three women that was released today, what can you tell from that video in terms of their surroundings? And it doesn't look like they're underground as far as we can tell. We did have Yocheved Livshitz, the elderly lady who was released last week, who talked about being taken into the tunnels and being held underground. What do you make of what you see in that video? What does it tell us?
I mean, it does look above ground. I think that makes a certain amount of sense. I think they probably have the prisoners spread out all over the place. What you said about Livshitz, she said she was underground, like you said, in a spider's web, and she walked for kilometers. And then she said she was held in a room with about 25 other people. So that's another clue that they're not all massed together, or that there's the possibility that there's large chunks, chunks like 25 people that could be released, you know, virtually right away. There's a parameter of an exchange where you would release the civilians and the elderly people and the younger people. For the elderly people, the young people, you know, there's 200 Palestinian kids in jail. Just release the kids. Release the kids from jail. Release the civilians. Start the process. Show your country that you're not going to just throw people into, you know, into the abyss. The parameters are there for the deal. I think the clues that we saw from that is, yeah, it looks like they're above ground, and that would make sense that 50 people have died if people are being held above ground, because it's not clear that you would flee where you're staying with the prisoners. And so when they're telling people to evacuate and then bombing them, I think you can assume that that's what's happening. I think the things that they said that we've heard from the prisoners so far are that generally they're being well cared for. The last two that were released said that they, you know, saw doctors, they're given their medications. And like Abu Ubaida said all along, our prisoners eat what we eat, drink what we drink. They take care of them. But the sort of just like rage about Israel to just so openly say that they're sacrificing these people, I'm not surprised they're mad. I can't imagine what it would be like to be abandoned for 9 hours like they were on that day, October 7th. And then when you're taken, the army's reaction is to say, we don't care about the difficult you know, because from Israel's point of view, yeah, it's difficult to release Palestinian resistance fighters that you thought you put in jail for the rest of their lives. You thought you effectively killed them. And now you have to confront letting them out of prison. But for the core of the state of Israel's ideology, to me, it's perplexing that they're not just getting on with this. There's very easy initial stages, as Abu Ubaida said, to do it in segments. It doesn't have to be all at once. Do it in segments. Show good, you know, like goodwill. Allow the elderly Palestinian prisoners who you want to die in prison, let them out and let the elderly that the Palestinians have. These kind of basic things, to have them not be happening, I think is a real indictment of Israel. And I think there's a reason for people to be mad like that, to be abandoned and then to not even negotiate something that the whole world can see. Just do each for each. Do the children for the children. Do the elderly for the elderly. It's simple.
There does seem simple and does seem like the humane and compassionate thing to do. But then it would seem to me that humane and compassionate is not what Israel does, not even to its own, for its own people. But also, I did see a lot of Israeli commentators over the past couple of days saying that such a deal where they would release so many Palestinians would be a massive defeat for Israel. So it seems that macho image and maintaining that sense of strength is more important than the welfare of Israel's citizens. They will always look for a way to make Israel look aggressive and powerful and strong rather than actually do what's best for its people. But why don't we talk about some of the ground operations that we're seeing? And we also have a couple of videos that we can show. I think we should start, John, with one that was released, I think it was on Saturday or it was over the weekend, by the Qassam Brigades. This is the military wing of Hamas. And it shows them. Well, let's show it and then you can tell us what it shows. I think we have that coming up now. Go ahead.
Low.
So again, that was a video released by Qassam, which shows them firing a Cornet anti-tank guided missile at a Panther armored personnel carrier, which they say can hold up to 14 soldiers. John, why would Qassam release this video and what are they trying to say?
Well, I mean, I think that's the beginning of the troops moving into the buffer zone. Basically, Israel has enforced over the years a buffer zone around Gaza that's at about 2 kilometers deep, which they should. Previously, they were always able to operate freely in that zone. But clearly, we've seen over the last few days that they have had trouble getting into Beit Lahia, which is where that footage was. So there have anti-tank, anti-armor divisions within the Qassam Brigade's army. So that's a shot from their anti-armor division. On Israeli troop movements that we can see just from that video are moving through fields. And that's the thing that's interesting.
Actually, John, we have another video that was released by the... So the first one we just watched was released by the Palestinian resistance. Right. And now we have one that was released, I think, yesterday by the Israeli army. So let's look at that.
So you can see them. They're in the fields. They're all surrounded by fields.
So this is quite grainy footage. It was released by the Israeli army. And I assume that the purpose of this was to tell the Israeli public or the world public that look at us, we're inside Gaza, we're sending the troops in, we're doing what we said we'd do. And they haven't, but they haven't released much more than this in terms of detail. But when you look at this, John, that's the message Israel wants to send, but what do you see?
Well, I see right there is a farm. They're making it look like they're moving into built-up areas, but Beit Lahia in the north, they're farms. So they're moving through farmland on foot. And yeah, they're trying to show that their ground operation has begun because they've been touting this over the last few days. I don't see anything in that footage that indicates anything other than the troops are operating in the buffer zone. Which is one of the interesting features of the Gaza Strip, is that it's a densely populated urban environment, but it's also surrounded by fields, which gives the Palestinians a significant advantage because essentially they have overwatch. They can be in the buildings looking down over the farmland that Israel has to cross through. And so what Israel's going to have to do if they're going to move block by block is they're going to have to move into the fringes of the built-up areas, and then they're going to have to hold that. And I think at this point, what they're doing is just probing, trying to find where the anti-armor units are set up for this kind of advance. And as I said before, in previous wars, or even during the occupation, the Israelis were able to move to the fringes of Beit Lahia very easily. And what we've seen over the weekend, from what we understand, is they've gotten fierce resistance in the northwest as they're trying to come in from the north of Gaza, which is one of the main axes that they'll try to travel on, coming from the north to the south. And then they'll try to come in from the east, which is also what we saw them move in from the east into the settlement tracks that we talked about on the show last week. There's basic laneways, if you will, of movement that the Israelis can do into what used to be their settlements, which were what Sharon put in there in the 1970s as a military position. They were primarily military positions that they then put civilians in to give them a kind of fig leaf of legitimacy. So they're moving along those axes. We saw a video from Palestinians today of the Israelis moving in at Netzarim Junction, which used to be a main checkpoint in Gaza when the Israelis were there. It's where Mohammed al-Dura was shot at the beginning of the Second Intifada. So it's a flashpoint spot because it's the first built-up area. And we saw footage today of the only other footage that we've seen from Gaza of an Israeli tank turn its turret and just blow away a car of Palestinians on the road.
Let's take a look at that in a second. But before that, just in terms of context, so the Israelis say that they have gone into Gaza. This is kind of south of, from the east, but south of Gaza City, and they reached the Salah ad-Din Road, which is sort of the main north-south highway. Highway makes it sound bigger than it is, but the thoroughfare from the north to the south. And let's take a look at that video now, if we have it, that was taken today in Gaza. And this is said to be, I'm not sure exactly where it was taken, but it was in the context of this Israeli incursion.
So the civilian car sees them, turns around to try to get out of there.
And then the tank just blows them away, which is absolutely horrifying. And again, underscores that there is no safe place in Gaza. Time and again, Israel has attacked people on their way to the supposedly safer areas in the south, and of course continues to attack and kill hundreds and thousands of people in the south of Gaza in Khan Yunis and Rafah and all over. But what does that video tell you, John?
I mean, you can see on that when the car is fleeing in that video, you can see to both sides that there's farmland. So the Israelis are moving through the buffer zone, which was previously their territory. They enforced the buffer zone inside the wall of Gaza historically. And so they need to move through that area. They're showing us footage of them moving through the easiest possible area of the Gaza Strip. And the other things that we've seen, the capacity of resistance in the Gaza Strip, we've seen it from the north to the south. In the south, we saw last week Qassam brigades repel an Israeli invasion on the beach in Rafah, which is in the far south. We saw the story of the Israeli soldier getting killed by a single anti-tank unit fighter east of Khan Yunis, which is just a bit further north of Rafah. We know that they exchanged fire for hours with them to the east of Berej, which is in central Gaza. So that was in Nitzarim, where there was resistance as well. And in the north, there's been fierce resistance that we've seen from the Israeli side of the border in Beit Lahia, that they've been engaged in fighting along that axis as well. And we also saw last week Qassam fighters, naval frogmen, naval commandos come up from the sea inside Israel proper, inside an army base on the Zakim beach. And so just from that set of descriptions, we've seen them resist from the furthest southwest corner to the southeast corner, central Gaza, north Gaza, all along there, every axis that the Israelis have come in on, they've met resistance in the fields. They're not in the built up areas, which is a completely separate fight from what they're doing right now. And all through that, we've seen the Qassam brigades and Saraya al-Quds continually fire rocket barrages on Tel Aviv, rockets and mortar fire on mustering troops. And the reason they can do that is because, according to the Israelis, according to the IDF Gaza Division deputy commander, there's more than 1,000 rocket launching sites that are buried underground and are connected and can be reloaded from the tunnel apparatus. And so the ability to resist it has been constant. The Israeli alarms go off, are going off constantly. The ability to resist is there, even over this weekend, which we talked about, was this brutal communications shutdown that was accompanied by the worst aerial bombardment and artillery shelling strikes, according to the United Nations, of this entire brutal war, which seems incredible that we keep saying that it gets worse and worse. But to cut off power and then to subject the population to this brutal attack, and all throughout it, there was rocket fire, there was resistance. And so none of these tactics appear to be working other than to horrify people.
John, the Israelis do claim that they entered into built-up areas, and they claim that they attacked 600 so-called terrorist targets recently. And this is just, I believe, in the context of the north. And they claim they killed dozens of Hamas fighters and attacked anti-tank rocket firing posts and rocket launching positions and so on. Are you suggesting that Israel might not be telling the truth? Is that even something we could consider?
I mean, they said today that they hit 30 Qassam fighters that were mustering, that were all together, which seems like unlikely that they would do something like that.
Well, they may have
Qassam fighters doesn't make any sense. We saw them on October 7th go into Israel, like single file. They're a professional trained army. They're not going to be all 30 of them in one building. They're not going into urban area.
I mean, I'm not making light of this. They probably killed another family and then said that it was 30 Qassam fighters. Let's throw up this Washington Post story that came out over the weekend and that we looked at. This came out yesterday. And I mean, basically, it says that Israel is launching this ground operation that they know. Basically, it says it's in stages, but it's all shrouded in secrecy. They're going gradually. They're going area by area. And it gives the impression that there is a plan here. I know you read it, John. Were you impressed by this Israeli plan? When you read this, did you think, oh, my goodness, they really got something here? What did you make of it?
No, I mean, the plan, right, involves going block by block because they've promised to annihilate Hamas. So the only thing that we're seeing is them tiptoeing into the buffer zone on the outside of the built-up areas. The fight isn't going to be in those buffer zone areas. It's not useful for Palestinians to, first of all, to expose their tunnels in that area when you have just open fields. What they're waiting for, the Palestinians are waiting for them to come into the built-up areas where the entire environment of conflict changes. You start to have four dimensions of fighting, right? Above you, on the street level, below, and the Palestinians have shown the capacity to have a miniature air force that they use suicide drones. They struck an Israeli troop gathering with a suicide drone yesterday, and the Israelis confirmed that. The plan that the Israelis have, like, until we see them fighting day after day in urban, surrounded by buildings, with all of their armor in there, we're looking at those troop columns. We're looking at maximum 12 we saw in that one anti-tank missile shot. In order to do the plan that they're saying that they have to do, they need thousands of troops on the ground, on foot, walking beside the tanks. So when we start seeing footage of tanks in urban areas with soldiers walking beside it, that's when the beginning of the ground war happens. What we're seeing right now is Israeli maneuvers in the buffer zone that is the territory that Israel created. The point of the buffer zone is to make sure that Palestinians can't set up defensive positions in the buffer zone. The point of it is to push the rocket fire and mortar fire back 2 kilometers from the border and allow Israeli troops to move in that territory. So the entire design of the buffer zone was created by Israel as a defensive posture for their offensive operations. And so if they were unable to operate in the buffer zone, it would be absurd because it's their territory. Like the March of Return in 2018, 2019, when they were lying, the snipers would lie up on the hillside and just shoot people that came into that buffer zone because it's a massive open field. But what they're promising is urban warfare in the built-up areas, and none of that has not happened in these.
Let me put another scenario to you that I've seen bandied about as a possibility. Again, Israel isn't telling any of us what its plans are, but we see analysts putting around all these different ideas. So one thing I've seen suggests that the Israelis actually won't necessarily go into the center of Gaza City. They will try to surround Gaza City. Obviously, they can do that from the west, from the sea, pretty easily. They can do that to some extent.
Palestinians have defenses all along the sea. So saw yesterday that Shati camp was right, the target on Friday.
Yeah, but bear with me with this. Idea is that they can surround Gaza from the west, from the sea. They can surround it from the east, because obviously the Israeli border is on the east, and they can block it off from the north because the Israeli border is there as well. So really, the main problem for Israel is is blocking Gaza City off from the south, which means basically driving through the center of Gaza towards the sea and block, and then dividing Gaza north to south. And basically then you have surrounded Gaza City and the north of Gaza and blocked them off. And then you don't actually have to go and fight street by street or building by building in Gaza City. You just besiege it for months, because even if the Qassam and the resistance have supplies for months, eventually their supplies will run out, their rockets, their munitions, their fuel, or whatever it is. So the Israelis will just wait it out for months until they have exhausted Hamas that way. So that's another scenario. Again, this hasn't come from any Israeli official source. It's just things I'm seeing talked about. Does that make any sense to you?
Well, it's also important to note that Israel has a military censor. So it's not even like a journalist that's down on the border can be like, oh, I'm seeing this troop movement, and then report it like in most countries. In Israel, that's illegal. You'll go to jail for doing that. So the military censor controls all information. Israel has evacuated the entire south, and it's a closed military zone. So nobody can get even close to see what's happening. And so the messaging that we're getting from the Israelis is completely unchallenged in any way, all throughout their society, based on this military censor. And so we have to rely in some senses on Palestinian information, which is why the ground offensive corresponded with a shutdown of information coming out of Gaza, because I think that the Israelis wanted to avoid moving in on day one and getting smoked and having a spectacle of that this is going to be horrible, when they're trying to rally their troops to carry out what you described, a months-long siege of an urban environment with 50,000 fighters ready for you to do that. Because it's not a secret for Palestinians, the axes upon which the Israelis will move into the Gaza Strip. The Palestinians in Gaza know those axes better than anyone on earth. It defined their life for years and years. And if not the young kids, then their parents told them about what it was like. So moving along those axes is possible. Driving down the main street and splitting off the territory, that's to be in the area to have that kind of a siege is going to leave their troops open to attack. And what we've seen so far is maneuver operations and then withdrawal. So they're not actually moving into the center and then staying there. And if any kind of tunnel action, which is what they've promised, is to happen, they'll need to mass a significant number of troops in one spot, guard it, and then get to work on this tunnel destruction that they've talked about. And while they're doing that, the Palestinians are able to see where they are, see what their plan is. And that's part of the reason. Like, I didn't expect for the Israelis to come flooding across the border, nor did I expect the Palestinian resistance to, after all this time, get excited and blow their most important defensive positions. So it's a bit of a cat and mouse at first, just to see who's going to be the person that first gives up their positions, because these defensive positions are well known. This part of the war that's happening right now is the part of the war that's happened in every other war that Israel has carried out. They can move into this buffer zone, and they historically could move into this buffer zone very easily. They used to take up positions in Beit Lahia. That's what they did. They moved in and they took the first farmhouses, and then they could have overwatch over the Palestinians. But the other thing that the Israelis have to do now is anytime they're moving into the urban areas, they also have to have a rear flank cover, because the tunnels, the Palestinians have the possibility to emerge from areas that Israelis thought they had cleared and continue to fight. And so that poses a situation that's different than, say, the Americans in Fallujah, where they were able to just waste block by block and then move into that wasted territory. that's not applicable in the same way in Gaza, because the tunnels can be used for offensive purposes in the armed struggle.
The question is also, I think, I mean, it does seem to me, and I saw in the comments someone reminded me that Naftali Bennett, the former prime minister, has also put forward a similar kind of plan, where it would be about, you know, surrounding Gaza and basically starving Gaza into submission and starving the resistance into submission. But I also think, and maybe that's a discussion we can pick up next time, but Israel's problem has always been, or its military doctrine has always been, short wars on the other person's territory. I don't think Israel has ever, maybe with the exception of Lebanon in 1982, really had a war that has gone on for months, let's say a hot war. I mean, of course, this is, as some have called it, a 100 years war between the Palestinian people and the Israeli colonizers. But in terms of a hot war where the army is mobilized, I don't think they've had too many that have gone on for months, with all the impact that that has on the economy. And then, of course, the internal political situation and the demands to bring the captives home. So, I mean, is that a factor? Even if militarily speaking or logistically speaking, they could carry out this kind of prolonged siege to try to starve the Palestinian resistance, are there factors in the home front or internationally that also run against that?
Yeah, and I think that it risks the possibility that you just withdraw after this months of siege with nothing to show for it, because the promise, the military promise that you've made is that, I mean, Netanyahu visited his tunnel operation soldiers last week and told them that that Israel needed them to save Israel. And so to then just move in and siege and bomb from the air, that it's not clear that Israel can find somehow to spin a victory out of that. And you're right, the home front can't endure that kind of long siege. It doesn't seem to me possible. But that siege also presumes a lack of defensive capacity for the Palestinians, because to shut off and to encircle the area means you have fixed troop positions. You're not moving your armor back across the border where it's less visible, where it can be protected by your iron domes and whatnot. And so you're talking about moving permanently troops in to divide up the territory, which just leaves them vulnerable to attack. And that's the part of this war that we don't actually know, because we haven't seen Qassam's capabilities that have been built in the last 8 years. So we're trying to use examples that we know from 2014. That's a long time of tunnel building ago. That's a long time of having your own domestic weapons production industry that the Palestinians have had to create enough rockets to, we'll remember that they started this round of the war, was started on October 7th with the breaching of the prison walls and breaking out. So it's hard to imagine that the Palestinians that didn't expect them to advance, the Israelis to advance on these axes, and their battle plans generally, there's not a ton of options for that battle plan. You have to assume that the Qassam brigades are prepared for that, but there's no real reason to expect
John,
that
spectacular. Sorry to interrupt you. We will come back to this. Nora, I believe we have someone with us who can only stay for a short time.
We do. We are very grateful for Ahmed Al-Nauk to join us right now. Ahmed is the founder of We Are Not Numbers. He has just a few minutes, but we wanted to bring him on. Ahmed, thank you so much for joining us today. You're in the UK, but your family and extended family and community is in Gaza. Can you talk about what you've been going through the last 3 weeks. We know that it's just been extraordinarily traumatizing and full of grief for you and your family.
I'd also just like to say welcome, Ahmed, and yeah. I'm sorry that we are speaking to you in these circumstances.
Yeah.
Many people will know, but not everyone, that on the 22nd of October, Israel bombed your family's home in Gaza and killed more than 20 members of your family, including your dear father, Nasri, and three of your sisters and two of your brothers and 15 of your nieces and nephews. And it's an unspeakable crime, and we offer you our sincere condolences. But you've been speaking out. You have not been staying silent. And so we just are in awe of your ability to speak in public when you're also grieving such an unspeakable loss.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me and giving me this platform to talk about the situation in Gaza and to talk about my family and everyone in Gaza. Just before I answer your question, I just want to elaborate that I am not the founder of We Are Not Numbers. I'm a co-founder. There are a number of friends and colleagues who started this project with me and who give a lot of their time and resources to this project. So we are grateful to everyone who helped creating this project. And since you mentioned the project of We Are Not Numbers, it's actually... I'm feeling some kind of deja vu here because We Are Not Numbers started in 2014 after I lost my brother and after I wrote about him for the first time. And the story I wrote about my brother was the inspiration for We Are Not Numbers, the creation of this platform to tell the human stories behind the numbers in the news. And part of me wanted, I was very proud of We Are Not Numbers because through We Are Not Numbers, we wanted to show the world that behind the numbers that you see in the news, there are stories of humans that deserve and they should be told to the media, especially in the Western media. And I never thought...
Ahmed, so people know, We Are Not Numbers is a project that you co-founded that nurtures young writers in Gaza to write their stories and to write what is going on and to publish it. And it's been an incredibly successful project. And many of the writers that we published from Gaza at the Electronic Intifada have come to us through We Are Not Numbers. So it's been an absolutely fantastic way to put the voices of people in Gaza front and center and to share them with the world. So it's a great thing.
Thank you. Thank you for these words. I'm feeling some sense of deja vu right now because what happened in 2014 led me to write a story about my brother, and we wanted to show the world that behind these numbers there are people who have stories that should be told. And then now in 2023, I'm not losing one brother, I'm losing 21 family members, including my father, my two brothers, my three sisters, and all their children. So I have three sisters who were at our home and they lost all their children. So just to give you a sense of what happened in October 2020, my home is in Deir el-Balah. And Deir el-Balah is relatively a calm area. Usually there is not a lot of bombing. And my house is in the center of Deir el-Balah, the downtown. And three of my sisters who were already married came to my house because they wanted to seek refuge in our home because it's safer. So they left their homes in order to come to our home for their safety. And then in October the 22nd, the Israelis bombed my home. My home is consisted of four flats, one for myself, one for my father, one for my uncle, and one for my brother. And then this video that you're showing, it shows the remains of my house, which is some rubble. It's this is what you're seeing in this video is the house in which I was raised, and the house in which I was brought up, and all of my brothers and sisters were brought up. So my father, two brothers, three sisters, one cousin, and 14 of their children were in this home. They were peaceful, they were lovely, they were kind, they were never a threat to the Israelis. They never fired missile around this house. There were never any military access in our exercise in our house. And it was bombed for no reason, for no justification whatsoever. In this picture, there is my father, two of my brothers, my sister and her children. All of them were killed. And in a different circumstances, I would be taking so much time to grieve my family. It's been a week since I lost my family, and I should be grieving. But unfortunately, looking at the circumstances in Gaza and thinking about all the people who are living under the bombardment in Gaza, For a moment, I forgot about my family, and now I'm thinking about the 2.2 million people who live in Gaza. 1.1 million of them are children. Children who are like my nieces and nephews, the 14 of them who Israel killed without any justification. Without any justification, all of them were killed. You look at them, they were kind, they were peaceful, they were lovely. My brother, my younger brother, yes, so this is a picture of three of my nieces and nephews. Three of them are the daughters of my sister Aya. So Aya is married and she has three children. These are her children, Tamim, Muhammad, and Malak. So Malak was the only one who survived in this bombing, but she survived with severe burns, 50%, and then she was taken to the ICU. And then after one day, they had to take her off because it was needed for more urgent cases. And then she eventually succumbed to her wounds. And now she joins the 13 other nieces and nephews that I lost. So the number is 14. Malak was very intelligent, very kind, very lovely. She came to my sister after 5 years of trying to have a baby. So she was a blessing to her mother and father. The other two children, Muhammad and Tamir, they were the sweetest, the kindest kids. They were kids, and this is a recent picture. They were kids, and they were killed. And I don't know, all of this time, I would just think, why would Israel bomb a house that has 15 children in it, that has an old man? My father, it was born in 1948. This is my father. He's 75 years old. And as I said in this tweet, he was an eyewitness to every single atrocity that Israel committed against us since its establishment. And can you imagine, he was born only a few months after the Nakba, and he lived all of his life, 75 years, under occupation, under wars, under collective punishment, under siege. He lost his son in 2014, and then he lost his wife in 2020. My mother died, not because of a bombing, but I would say she was killed by the Israelis because they did not allow her to have a treatment from cancer. She was struggling with cancer for 2 years. And no matter how hard we try to get her a permit to receive her chemotherapy from the West Bank, in the West Bank, the Israelis never gave her the permit until it was too late. So they gave her the permit, but it was too late. When I called the doctors in Jerusalem, they told me she could have been cured, but you sent her to us so late. So this is the life that we're going through. And this is one thing that I always try to emphasize on. Our story, our struggle did not start from the 7th of October. It started 75 years ago and more, 106 years ago, since the Balfour Declaration, in which Balfour, the UK, gave Israel, the Zionists, the right to live and exist in our homeland with a disregard to the Palestinian people, to the indigenous people. Not only that, but they also made us a minority, people without any civil rights, without freedom, without liberty, without sovereignty over their lands. And ever since, we have been struggling, and wars and besiegement and collective punishment and many, many other crimes. So this is the story of my family and every one of my family. I mean, in 2014, when Israel killed my brother, I never got tired of telling people here in the UK and America and all over the world about the story of my brother and how that led to the creation of We Are Not Numbers. But now I have another 21 family members who each one of them have a story that needs to be told. And right now it's not a time for weakness. It's not the right time to grieve and take my time with crying over them. Now it's the time to work, because if we do not work right now to stop the atrocities that are being perpetuated in Palestine, in Gaza, more families will be losing their lives. More people like me will grieve for the loss of their family. So I applaud what you're doing right now, talking about Palestine. This is something that we really need here in the West. People need to hear our stories. People need to know what's actually going on in Palestine, not just the condemning Hamas and the hostages and all of this nonsense. We need people to hear the real stories from the people who are suffering on the ground. And this is what you are trying to do. So I applaud you for that. I thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to speak about my family. And I'm telling you right now, I will never be silenced, and I will never stop talking about my family. I will never stop talking about my brothers and sisters. And father and mother and everyone, and not only my family, but also the other families and the other Palestinians who live under this bombardment, who live under this cruelty for not only 17 years of a blockade, the collective punishment, but also the 75 years of occupation, of besiegement, of settlement expansion, and all of these atrocities.
Ahmed. So,
yes.
Ah, sorry. I wanted to ask you where your family is from originally, before the Nakba. Can you talk a little bit about the origins of your family and some of that history?
So my mother came from Beer Saba. It's what you call now Beersheba, what they call it. She came from Beer Saba, and she lived in Gaza after that. My father's family, my grandfather used to live in Gaza and in Yaffa as well. My grandmother is from Yaffa. So we had the properties in Yaffa, and we used to live in Yaffa. And then they came to Gaza and they settled in Gaza. And this is actually an important point that you have raised. Gaza, 70% of the population in Gaza are not from Gaza. They are from towns and cities that Israel ethnically cleansed in the 1948, and then we came to Gaza. So you're talking about over 1.4 million Palestinian refugees living in the Gaza Strip. And the 7th of October is not the first incident. It's not where the clock started. Our story began 75 years ago, and we are still, you know, we're talking about 1.4 million people who live in Gaza, who are actually not from Gaza, and they have been fighting and struggling in order to get the basic human necessities and the basic freedoms that every other human person should enjoy. 70% of the Palestinians in Gaza are not from Gaza. They are refugees who are forced to live in Gaza because of the ethnically cleansing that happened to them 75 years ago.
Yeah.
Ahmed, I think part of Israel's cruelty is that there is no time, as you said, there is no time to grieve, because it's one atrocity after another. And I think the latest figures from the health ministry were that almost 900 families had been massacred in just the way that your family was massacred. So looking at the photos of your father and your sisters and your nieces and your nephews, and it really does bring home the reality behind these numbers, that we as a Palestinian people are not numbers. And so for you to be able to speak about your family under these circumstances, to me, is just incredible. But I think they would be very proud of you for being able to have the strength and to show the strength to do that. And I know you're in the UK and you're talking to a lot of media there right now, which is one reason we don't want to take up too much more of your time. You've been very generous with us. But I would like to ask you what the response has been in the UK from various sectors. And what kind of reaction are you getting when you tell your story and when you talk about Palestine there?
Well, we have seen in London some of the biggest demonstrations that hundreds of thousands of people took to the street every Saturday in London to protest what Israel is doing in Palestine, to call for freedom for the Palestinian people and justice for the Palestinian people, and to hold the war criminals into account. And I have seen that the British people, at their heart, they're very, very nice and kind people. And the majority of them are peace lovers. All of them. I think everyone is a peace lover. Everyone wants peace. Everyone wants freedom for the Palestinian people. But I'm just disappointed with the media in the UK. I'm disappointed with their coverage. When in the 7th of October, we have seen that they have provided a lot of cover for the Israelis to do massacres against the Palestinian people. And I have noticed that on the first day of the 7th of October, when I noticed what the media is doing, I knew that Israel will do something very big. They will commit as many massacres as they could because they have been given the cover to do so. We have seen them disseminate false information, lies about what actually happened, 40 decapitated babies, rape, and so many lies. And when you think about it, these journalists, I mean, I did my master's degree in journalism here in the UK, and I've done my dissertation on the Western media coverage on the March of Return, and I've read the literature on the coverage of Palestine from the Western media. And these mainstream media, some of them, not all of them, some of them knew that what they are doing is not professional. Disseminating lies like this without any proof is not professional, and it will lead to a catastrophe in Palestine, but they did it nonetheless. And I think they intentionally wanted to disseminate information that would eventually give Israel the cover and the atmosphere to commit as many atrocities that they desire. And that's what I am disappointed with. I'm not disappointed with the British people. The British people are kind, they are lovely, and they are pro-justice, they're pro-peace. And I've seen them in the streets of London, hundreds of thousands of people. And I'm also disappointed with the political level in the UK. Whether it was the Labour or the Conservative Party, the leadership of these parties did not do justice when they tackled this conflict between Israel and Palestine. But I am hopeful. When I took to the streets, when I see the hundreds of thousands of people, not only Palestinians, some people misunderstand the situation. These people who took to the streets are not Palestinian, they're not Arabs. Some of them Arabs, of course, but many, many of them are actually Jewish people who are pro-Palestine, who are pro-justice. Many of them are British, white people. You go to the street and you see people from all ethnicities, people from everywhere. People traveled all the way from Scotland, from north of Yorkshire, from Cardiff, from all around the UK. They came and they took the effort and they came to the streets in order to tell their politicians, to tell the media that your judgment is no longer valid and the coverage of the media is no longer trusted, and we do not believe what you're telling about the Palestinian people. They say that they believe in the Palestinian people and the coverage of the citizen journalists who are now in Gaza. And I want to say that I'm very, very, very proud of the Palestinian people. Every one of them right now in Gaza is serving as a journalist. Everyone is taking photos, pictures, telling news about what's actually going on in the media. And that's what, and the coverage of the Palestinian citizen journalist is now countering the mainstream media. And it's changing the narrative about Palestine. And that's why we have seen a huge change when it comes to the perception of the British people about Israel and Palestine. I mean, in the 70s and the 80s, you could hardly find someone who's aware of the political situation. You could hardly find someone who is pro-Palestine. Right now, I would say that maybe 70% of the British people are politically aware about what's going on in Palestine, and they are pro-justice, pro-peace in Palestine. So. And this is something I also wrote about on Twitter. I said that the disparity between the political will and the popular will in Britain is actually astonishing. You go to the streets and you see massive crowds of people protesting for Palestine, and then when you look at the political level at the prime minister and the government in the UK, you find something totally is completely different. And this is something that we need to talk about, actually. It's time for the British government and the politicians and the major political parties in the UK to listen to the streets, to listen to the base of their constituencies, and to answer the demands of the British people, because this is, after all, a democracy. And in a democracy, the people should have a say. They should have the ruling on how the UK should tolerate its foreign policy.
Yeah. Well, Ahmed, no, we know that that you have to go. You are in between many media appearances, and so we want to just thank you so much for coming on to the live stream today. We've gotten just a flood of comments while you've been talking from some of our viewers and listeners. Thanking you. I think everybody is here holding you and holding your grief,
and your anger
and your anger
and absolutely. Your anger. And I just have to say, Ahmed, that the tweets you've been posting with the stories, the pictures and the stories of your family have been such a wonderful memorial to them. And at the same time, you have expressed your anger and your defiant rage at what Israel has done to your family and to so many other Palestinians, and the way you're turning that into work in order to continue to try to stop this genocide is really something that is amazing to us. And thank you for doing that, and thank you for being an example for all of us in an impossible, horrifying situation.
Well, thank you very much. I would like to add something.
Yeah.
Now, you have invited me to speak about my family, but my family is not the only family that has been wiped out from the face of earth. Many, many, many other families, many, many other people lost their entire families. In 2021, our colleague Zainab Al-Qolak lost 22 family members. And she was 22 years old when she lost 22 family members. And I excuse her. She couldn't talk a lot about it because it's a very traumatic experience. And so many other Palestinians lost many, many family members, and they couldn't talk about it because it's too difficult. But for me, it's very difficult for me to talk about it. And I can't say that I am as powerful as I seem. I'm a very emotional person, and I love my family. I loved my father more than anyone could love his father. I love him very, very, very much. He was the kindest, the most compassionate person you could ever meet. I always say that he's the kindest person that he ever walked this earth. And my heart bleeds for my father. My heart bleeds for my older brother and younger brother and the nieces and nephews. But I think this is also, I think we Palestinians don't have the luxury to grieve enough for our parents. We have a responsibility now to talk. And I also have a responsibility because I speak English. So I have a responsibility towards the British people, the people who I live among, to tell them about what's going on. But many other Palestinians don't have this voice. They can't speak English. They don't have telecommunication right now to tell their stories. And it's our responsibility, me and your responsibility, and everyone's responsibility to magnify the voices of the Palestinians who are in Gaza. Many of you as journalists and many of the listeners or the people who are watching us now, they know, they are politically aware about what's going on in Palestine, and they can spread the word about Palestine. They can spread the stories of people who are in Palestine. So I think it's a collective responsibility that all of us, every one of us, share right now. It's not up to me as a journalist to talk. It's not up to you only as journalists to talk about Palestine. It's up to every single one. We have been failed by the mainstream media in the West. So, and we have lost hope in the media to change. Now we have a lot of hope on the people, on the free people of the world, every one of them, to share our stories and to work as a journalist on his own. They shouldn't only talk about Palestine in the media, but they can talk to their neighbors, to their friends, to their family, to everyone about what's going on in Palestine, because what's going on in Palestine is dire, and people are dying. Now there are more than 10,000 people died in Gaza, killed in Gaza, murdered in Gaza, massacred in Gaza. If we do not stop that, more and more, thousands of people will die. So it is up to us as people who live in the West to speak out and to speak about what's going on in Palestine, to write to our MPs and to demand a change both in the media and in the political sphere in the UK and in America. That's my final message. Please do not lose hope in Palestine. The Palestinian people are powerful. They are strong. They can survive. But we need your help so that you help them to survive and to live a dignified life, not only a life. We don't want a life under siege and occupation and collective punishment and all of that. We are sick and tired of this life. We want a dignified life. We want to be free. We want to live it free. And it is up to every single one of you to help us accomplish this dream. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ahmed.
Thank you, Ahmed. We take your words seriously and we will continue to do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we wanted to kind of circle back on what we were talking about with John. I wanted to also bring in our colleague Tamara Nassar. Tamara,